I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. By now, you've probably seen the videotape of Sandra Bland being pulled over by a Texas state trooper on July 10th. What began as a routine stop quickly escalated, ending with Bland being charged with assault. She was taken to a local jail and 3 days later was found hanging in her cell. Her death was ruled a suicide, which her family disputes. She had been in the process of moving to Texas to take a new job. Many questions have been raised about the trooper's actions and the inaction of jail employees to be more vigilant. Bland had told them that she had contemplated taking her life, but they did not put her on a suicide watch. This tragic encounter shed light on the often overlooked interactions between Black women and the law. We begin our conversation with David Harris. He's a professor of law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law, teaches criminal procedure, criminal law evidence, and courses on criminal justice policy, has written several books, including most recently Failed Evidence, Why Law Enforcement Resists Science. And David Harris, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Great to be with you again, Marty. How are you?
I'm very well. And I have many questions, as I think many people do as well. And I do want to walk through this stop, because I think there are key moments in this stop. What really strikes me, and I think a lot of people, is that Sandra Bland was pulled over for not using her blinker, something we probably all do on a routine basis. Was this trooper within the law to pull her over for that?
Yes, he was. And the Supreme Court has said exactly that, that any time there is evidence, and seeing an offense would be evidence, anytime there's evidence of a traffic offense, that constitutes full probable cause for a police officer to pull a driver over, investigate, talk, get the documents, check them, and then give a warning or a citation. So he was within his rights to do that, even though it might seem kind of trivial. The traffic code is full of trivial, small offenses. And police do know this, and it's one of the reasons why using traffic stops as a way to investigate other crimes is such a common thing.
Well, and apparently he was about to give her a warning until this altercation took place, that he wasn't actually going to give her a ticket, but just a warning. Based on your reading, is that correct, David?
Well, I heard him say that in the video recording, that it was going to be a warning. I don't have any way to verify that. He seems to say that he has it on paper, and I think we could take him at his word. What's really going on here is the use of legal authority to address something entirely different, and that is he did not like her attitude. And that is why things went so terribly wrong here. He was using his legal authority in a couple of different ways. First, to pull her over, and then the whole thing escalated as he used that legal authority in ways that were not designed to de-escalate the situation, but to assert himself. That's how things went wrong.
Well, let me play a selection from this audio tape, or actually it's videotape. This is the Texas State Trooper, Brian Encina. He's asking Sandra Bland to put out her cigarette after pulling her over for failing to signal, and let's give it a listen.
You mind putting out your cigarette, please? Don't mind.
I'm in my car. Why do I have to put out my cigarette?
Well, you can step on out now.
I don't have to step out of my car.
Step out of the car. Step out of the car.
No, you don't have the right.
Step out of the car.
You do not have the right to do that.
I do have the right. Now step out or I will remove you.
I refuse to talk to you other than to identify myself.
Step out or I will remove you.
I am getting removed for a failure.
Step out or I will remove you. I'm giving you a lawful order.
David, was he within the law to ask her to put out her cigarette?
No, he was not. And that is really the moment when the whole thing goes terribly wrong. He doesn't have any right to tell her to put out her cigarette. And I think he actually realizes that, because you notice he says to her, "Would you mind please putting out your cigarette," or something like that. And she just says, "No, I don't have to. This is my car." And he follows that almost unnaturally quickly with, "Step out of the car now." He has the lawful right to order her out of her car. The Supreme Court has set the rules on this a long time ago. A police officer has the right to order any driver, or any passenger for that matter, out of the vehicle for any reason or for no reason, with evidence, without evidence. And the Supreme Court has said this is simply a safety thing, and he's got the right to do that. But you can see just how by how quickly it all happens together with the cigarette thing. What he's doing is he's exercising that lawful authority at a point where he has already, according to his own words, decided just to give her a warning and she's no danger. He has used that lawful authority in reaction to her saying, I don't have to put my cigarette out. So this is so clearly about, I'm going to assert my authority to show you, driver, who's boss. I asked you nicely to put out your cigarette, and you gave me lip for it, and here's what you get. And so he is within his legal authority to order her out. However, that legal authority is used for something that I think any good police officer would tell you, that's just not the way to go.
Well,
you know, if you've already decided the thing is over, let it be over.
Let me play another selection, another clip from this videotape. It comes shortly after the state trooper tells her to put out her cigarette. Let's listen.
Get out of the car now.
Why am I being apprehended? You're trying to give me a ticket.
I said get out of the car.
Why am I being apprehended?
You I'm giving you a lawful order. I'm going to drag you out of here.
So you're going to drag me out of my own car?
Get out of the car.
And then you
I will light
me?
You up. Get out.
Wow.
Now.
David, when he says I'll light you up, he's saying I'm going to tase you.
Yes, he is. And I can tell you from personal experience, having been through the taser training, that is no joke. It is a use of force. And what is happening here is that this incident has now escalated in a matter of seconds because she refused his suggestion, a request to put out the cigarette. Then he orders her out. That is a lawful order. She says no. She is refusing a lawful order, but all because of this business with the cigarette where he did not like her attitude. So he decides when she won't do it, he's going to use force on her or threaten to use force on her, both in the form of, quote, dragging her out or using a taser on her in order to effectuate his lawful order. Again, we see the sort of the structure of lawful authority, a lawful order, use of force to effectuate the lawful order, all in service of just asserting one's dominance. And that is just the wrong way to go about policing in any situation. And you know, at some point he clearly just loses his temper. And that takes over. And when the temper is riding lawful authority, boy, you're in for some pretty bad outcomes.
My understanding is it's Sandra Bland asked something like 14 times, why am I think, being arrested, or why, you know, in a sense, sort of why is this happening to me? Did he adequately answer that question?
Well, he's not obligated under the law to answer why somebody is getting arrested. But almost every police department I've ever worked with has within its own rules or policies or protocols that it is best practice to tell somebody, here's why I stopped you, here's why I'm arresting you, here's why, and to respond to the extent that the officer is able and the response does not cause any problem or danger. The reason is a response like that can help to diffuse the situation. And he just utterly refuses. By that point, the police officer is so carried away with his temper, with her refusal to go along with his orders and so forth, that he's not only not going to answer, he's going to make sure she complies, puts her on the ground, things like that.
Do you think she was being rude to this trooper?
Yes, she was. But you know what? It's not illegal to be rude to a police officer. It may not be smart. It may not be nice. It may not be courteous. But police officers have to be, by virtue of their job, they have to take some of that. Now, that's not, you know, that's just a fact of life. If you don't want that job, don't take that job. But you don't have a right as a police officer to arrest somebody for being rude to you or saying bad things to you. Those things go with the territory. You have to be able to withstand some of that. He does not have the right to treat her this way because she is being rude. And she was being rude. I mean, she used some real profanities, called them names, all kinds of other stuff. Does not matter. He does not have the right to treat her this way or to arrest her just for that.
And this removal, I mean, removing her from the car, is that for the officer's safety? Is that the reason why people are removed from their cars?
That is the rationale. And the reason for that, the Supreme Court says, is that coming up to a civilian's car as a police officer is a situation that is fraught with a certain amount of danger. And that's correct. I mean, the person inside the car is in a position to reach things in the car that may be concealed, such as evidence that might be destroyed, such as a weapon, of course. And there are incidents every year in the United States in which police officers are killed at traffic stops. So the Supreme Court has just simply said, look, if there's any reason that the officer feels the least bit like there might be some danger, the officer can, without any second guessing at all, order the person out of the car. And it does not matter what the police officer's motive is. We simply say the police officer has power to do that. And what you see here is somebody taking that power when there clearly wasn't any danger. He had already decided, he said, give her a warning. He's not in danger, but he uses that power because he's offended, because she's given him lip and given him attitude. Police officers call that finding somebody in contempt of cop. And that's what went on here, and that's what went wrong.
Are black motorists more likely to be arrested for these minor infractions?
I think you'd have to look at the data for any individual police department or any individual geographic area. My strongly informed guess would be generally they are. I have looked at that data for certain places, not for Waller County, Texas. And usually there is a greater chance that black motorists, minority motorists generally, do get cited and do get arrested more for minor things like this. It is an unfortunate fact that, when black parents have kids getting to driving age, they tell them in a way that white parents simply don't have to, you must unfailingly be careful, calm, never give the officer any lip, hands at 2 and 10, those kind of things. I never heard that growing up as a kid. Many black parents feel that this is a mandatory talk they have to have because this is something that happens all too frequently. It is something that I think if you talk to African Americans, you'd find a lot of people have had it happen to them, or dad has had it happen, brother, friend, cousin, whoever.
We're almost out of time here, but do you hope out of this tragedy there will be some reforms?
Well, I think there's already reexamination going on a wide scale. I think there's a reexamination of the way that police approach situations like this. Do you really want to stop every car that might have made a traffic offense? Do you really want to have an encounter where you assert your dominance just because you can? I mean, having the power to do something because you and saying, I can do this, doesn't mean you should do it. And the sort of warrior mentality that has pervaded American law enforcement for the past several decades is really coming home to roost. And I think it's responsible for some of these incidents, racial or not. There is just too much of that.
David Harris, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
A pleasure to be with you, Marty.
You're welcome. Professor of Law at the University of Pittsburgh School of Law. Much more after this very short break and two more guests. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. Sandra Bland's funeral was held on Saturday, about 2 weeks after she was pulled over by a state trooper for failing to use her blinker. And what should have been a routine traffic stop quickly escalated and led to Bland's arrest and her death 3 days later ruled a suicide. Joining us now is Dorothy Roberts. She's the George A. Weiss University Professor of Law and Sociology and the Raymond Pace and Sadie Tanner Moselle Alexander Professor of Civil Rights at the University of Pennsylvania. Dorothy Roberts, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's good to be back.
And also with us and joining us by telephone is Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, Director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. That's at Columbia Law School, also founded, which she founded in 2011. Also co-founder of the African American Policy Forum and co-author of a brand new report titled Say Her Name. And Kim, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Really happy to be here.
Nice to have you. And I know that you and Dorothy know each other. So just so the audience knows, we've got two friends talking with each other.
Way back.
Yeah, that go way back. Dorothy, only because I was watching you as I was interviewing David Harris, you were fast and furiously scribbling notes there. as I said, we only got to the traffic stop. We haven't even gotten what happened in this jail cell. What are your thoughts, though?
Well, my thoughts are that I think David was giving a very sort of balanced view of the legal prerogatives of Officer Ancinia, but every single point that he made about probable cause, about traffic stops, about attitude, about police showing who's the boss and the warrior mentality, all of that is completely laden with racism and white supremacy. So, you know, why did he go after Sandra Bland? You can see in the video that he makes a U-turn and goes after her, and then when she fails to signal, he stops her. The traffic stop as a pretext for looking for other things. We know that in every study I've ever seen, blacks are far more likely to be stopped and for violence to be meted against them by police officers during that stop. This so-called attitude, she was asserting her rights. It's almost exemplary the way that she knew her rights at every single point, and she asserted her rights. She asked why she was being stopped multiple times. And the idea of a police officer showing who's boss, it has a particular significance when it's a white police officer encountering or stopping a black person. What we read, black people read in this is, know your place, black person. And your place is not to talk back to a police officer or even to assert your rights. And so for us, ending up dead because you asserted your rights is someone who was standing up to racism and got hit with this kind of white supremacy. So I think it's really important to understand that every single point of this and the extent of force also, being threatened with a taser,
to get out of the car.
You know, knocked. I mean, you didn't play the part where she says, you slammed my head to the ground. I can't even hear. Why was that amount of force necessary to restrain her? And in so many cases, black people are killed because police officers use excessive force on some legal pretext, fear of the... But it doesn't matter. It's a racist use of force that is unnecessary to restrain somebody. And you're right. We haven't even gotten to what happened to her in the jail.
And we haven't even gotten to Kim, who I know wants to add to that. Kim, anything you want to say to what Dorothy was just saying?
I just wanted to say that there was much note scribbling across the country in the same way. And I just, everything Dorothy said is absolutely right. And, you know, to put a point on it, a lot of people are talking about this as though the answer to whether this should have happened or not is only whether it was lawful or not. And in fact, some people actually believe that simply saying it's lawful is a response to our concerns that it was racially inflected. It's almost as if it is lawful, it isn't racist. And if it's racist, it isn't lawful. But in fact, that's just not the case in Fourth Amendment law. So what this is a textbook illustration of is the way that Fourth Amendment law does not protect black people against racially profiled experiences, nor is it a barrier or an obstacle against police officers who want to use their authority under the Fourth Amendment to do things that are, in fact, racist things. And if anything, this is a case that shows us that Fourth Amendment law is broken and that our social conversation about some of the costs and consequences to black people of unrestrained policing practices is that the simple assertion of your rights could put you in jail, and that might end up leading to your death. However it happened, it started from an abuse of authority, and that's the piece that's difficult for people to talk about in terms of race.
Well, let me just pick up on that, Kim, and if I can go back to you. Are you saying it was racist because this is a white police officer and a black female motorist in this case? And as you mentioned, the Fourth Amendment, that's about search and seizure, that because of the way he treated her, that was innately racist?
So I'd say that the broad part of the problem is that the Fourth Amendment permission that he had was enough to cover every moment of decision making that was likely inflected by their racial identity. So the very decision to follow Sander in the first place, we know that black women, as much as black men, are subject to racially disproportionate encounters with the police through the very decision to begin to chase someone. And that's not subject to Fourth Amendment protection. So if he saw Sander and just thought, what's this black woman doing here? He has the right to actually tail her. In addition, she says, as Dorothy mentioned, the reason Sander pulled over was because he was tailing her closely and she thought he wanted her out of the way. And then that becomes bootstrapped as the reason for the intervention. We go into the intervention from the beginning. Where are you? Where are you going? How long have you been here? That's really not important information, and we don't think it was relevant to the reason he said she stopped her, a change of lane. You don't need to know how long someone's been here to investigate that. And then we go all the way over to the moment of his effort to push her out of the car. And as we've heard, it was clearly an expression of outrage that he asserted her rights. But it's not just that she was asserting her rights. She's a black woman in her own car saying, I don't have to do this. He is a man, a white man, looking at a black woman who has already probably been stereotyped as rude, crude, in need of discipline. We know that because this is a common stereotype about black women. And there's nothing in the law of Fourth Amendment that prohibits him from saying, okay, I'm not going to take it from this sassy, brassy woman, and I'm going to immediately become as aggressive as I need to be to assert my authority. Our colleague Phil Goff has done research that shows that one of the most significant predictors of when a police officer is going to use excessive force is not just race, but it's also race and gender. It's also whether their masculinity has been challenged and whether they feel insecure about this. And we know that in that particular kind of encounter was a masculinity question. In fact, Sander said so when she was on the ground. So it was clear what this was about between the two of them. And the problem is it's not clear to the broader public, and it's definitely not clear to the law.
Well, I do want to talk about what happened or perhaps what didn't happen when she was taken to this Waller County Jail. And Dorothy, I'm back at you. Mm-hmm. Apparently some forms that she filled out, one certainly referenced the fact that she had thought about suicide, apparently had a miscarriage, had thought about perhaps even taking pills related to taking her own life, and yet she wasn't put on any kind of suicide watch. How do you interpret that? And there is some investigation going into what happened in this jailhouse. But how many other violations do you think? And the idea of hanging yourself with a plastic trash bag, I still can't quite get my mind around that.
Yes, many of us can't get our mind around it, especially because she seems like somebody who was the last person who would commit suicide. She had just arrived with a new job that she was very excited about taking on. She was an outspoken person, as we can see on the video, but also she has other videos where she speaks against racism. She knew that her family was about to send her the money to be bailed out, and she would be released soon. So there are many, many questions about whether or not she committed suicide in the first place, and there's no reason to trust what comes out of Waller County.
Why do you say that?
Because we already know that the police officer lied about her kicking him, and that's why he had to use this type of force against her. Now the video reveals that wasn't true at all. What other untruths are coming out? They have every incentive to cover up. And we know from videotapes now that police officers and sheriffs do things to cover up their crimes against people. So I think the family is suspicious about whether there was a suicide. But apart from that, let's say she did commit suicide, and I'm saying that hypothetically. We have to see what comes out of the investigation, if we can trust that investigation. But if they suspected she was suicidal and did not put her on suicide watch, put her in a cell with a trash bag that she could use to hang herself, they're accountable as well. And, you know, I teach criminal law. I think Kim teaches criminal law as well. You can be accountable for a death as a homicide even if the person commits suicide, even if it's by... Oh, absolutely. I teach cases where someone is driven to suicide by a defendant's actions, and they're held accountable for it. And so whether it was their action, their inaction, we know that she ended up dead in that jail cell because of the behavior, the outrageous behavior of the arresting officer, and also this sheriff, who it has been revealed was fired for racist conduct against citizens of the county in 2008. So I think there's a lot to be suspicious of in their explanations of what happened to her and whatever happened. I can say now that they are accountable for her death.
Kim, let me go back to you. This report that just came out, say her name, goes through a number of interactions between black women and law enforcement. One headlined here, Driving While Black. Another one headlined, Death in Custody, Black Women as quote-unquote superhuman and incapable of feeling pain. Just picking up on that, but also staying close to this case and the many questions about Sandra Bland. Anything you want to add to what Dorothy just said?
Oh, absolutely. And one of the things that we have to remember is that one of the reasons why Sandra Bland was so distraught was that she was also isolated. And one of the reasons she was isolated was the nature of the charge that the police made up against her made her more vulnerable. And so therefore she was put in a cell by herself. So the trauma that she experienced, that if that is what led to her death, was directly the consequence of the abuse of authority in the first place, which in turn was the result of a lie. When we see the videotape, we know that the reason the officer couldn't give her a reason for her arrest is he didn't have one yet. And so then he goes back and makes up a story that places her at risk when she is incarcerated. So I completely agree with Dorothy. The causal chain from this all begins with the police officer's actions and then the failure of the sheriff or anyone else in the department to review the tape, to look at the intake file, and to basically release her. She should not have had to spend one night in that jail. More broadly, I think our report creates a context for this, because some people will read this as a man bites dog kind of story, like who knew that black women were subject to police abuse and violence. So our report basically says that there are other Sandra Blands out there who've been abused, and some even wound up dead because of a routine traffic stop or a traffic violation turning into a deadly situation. And so this is a very common way that black people become into contact with police. And through that expressive and expansive story, the officers are able to interact with them in a way that we believe is clearly influenced by their race. And then black women are also experiencing threats and risk of violence and death from the police being called to their homes to help them. So we have several women who were killed when their family members called the police because they were having a crisis. The police got there, and in the very same way as we saw, like Sandra Bland, saw the failure to comply with their orders as justification for excessive force. So Kayla Moore, Michelle Cousseau, Tanisha Anderson, all black women who were killed within the last year because police interpreted a situation as suggesting that there was a need for excessive force. So these women were killed by the police rather than help them. So we've got lots of different categories, ways, and encounters with the police that put black women in at risk of this kind of violence.
Dorothy, this is a more personal question to you, Kim, as well. When you get into your car, are there certain things that you do, Dorothy, just to, you know, if I get stopped, I want to make sure I have X, Y, and Z, or I'm going to behave a certain kind of way?
Oh, absolutely. First of all, I experience a higher heartbeat when I hear a police siren. You know, I do not have a sense of safety when I see. I could tell you just yesterday, I went for a walk, And there was a big police van parked at the end of the block around the corner. And I deliberately did not cross the street in front of that police car. I walked to the side of it because I have a sense that if I walk in front of a police officer, or if I'm stopped by the police officer, or if any encounter,
something could happen.
Something could happen. I absolutely feel that way. And I just know too many situations, Kim mentioned some of them, where Black women who are seeking protection end up being harmed, if not killed, by the police because we are viewed as angry, as noncompliant, as not vulnerable. This is, Kim mentioned this stereotype of Black women as angry and not in need of protection, but as in need of supervision and control. It runs very, very deep in American culture.
And Kim, about 45 seconds before our break here, but just if you don't mind, I'd be curious about your experience.
Well, I'll actually say that I had precisely an experience that Sandra Bland had on my campus. And fortunately, I, you know, ended up not being taken into custody. But a police officer did precisely the same thing to me, accusing me of jaywalking, pulled me out of a crowd of people who were jaywalking. And my assertion of my rights actually led him to handcuff me. And this is less than a quarter mile from where I've worked for 30 years. Right. So we all see in this precisely the kind of threat that Sandra Bland confronted.
And that's Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, director of the Center for Intersectionality and Social Policy Studies. That's at Columbia Law School, also co-founder of the African American Policy Forum and co-author of a new report just released this month called Say Her Name. Dorothy Roberts with us as well. She's a professor of law and sociology and civil rights at the University of Pennsylvania. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499 to join the conversation. Also send us an email. Got a lot of emails at Radio Times at WHYY.org and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about a number of things in this hour of the show, the death of Sandra Bland, many unanswered questions about why she was pulled over, what happened when she was incarcerated, held in jail, the community reaction, and the interactions between Black women and the police. We've got an explosion of phone calls here. I do want to play a clip from yesterday's interview on This Week. Attorney General Loretta Lynch responded to the arrest and the death of Sarah Bland. Also, the relations between police and the Black community. Let's give it a listen.
I think that we have a situation where many minority communities for so long have felt that law enforcement was coming in to essentially enforce laws against them, not to protect them.
Is that true, Dorothy? I mean, that seeing law enforcement, not necessarily, I'm not as your friend, but as your foe.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Based on a very long history of law enforcement using this kind of brutality, even fatal force against Black people, including, as we were just talking about, Black women when police are called to protect us. I think that is one of the most striking examples of our relationship as Black Americans to the police, is that even when they are called to protect, they so often end up harming or even killing us.
Kim, do you think in this Black Lives Matter and, you know, the number of deaths that we've seen in the last year, I'm thinking Eric Garner, Michael Brown, Tamir Rice, Walter Scott, Freddie Gray, do you think that Black women have been left out of this conversation?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, you were able to just show us is how the names of Black men killed by the police just roll off the tongue. But to put together a sentence that includes Tanisha Anderson and Michelle Cousseau and Rekia Boyd and any number of the other women who were killed this year really is a struggle. And so some part of the Say Her Name of movement is simply to say the most immediate way that we can correct this as a movement is to say their names when we say the names of the men who've also fallen to police violence. But the second and most, I guess, provocative point here is that if we begin to say the names of black women who are killed by the police, we'll be able to address more concretely some of the myths around the need to allow police this authority and this discretion, and the cost of that myth to black bodies. You asked whether or not, you know, black people generally see the police this way, and mm-hmm. Dorothy said absolutely. And I'll add to that, that this policing that we are experiencing is very much like slave patrols. That's how African-Americans first encountered the police, and the basic logic of the patrol was keep white people safe, even if it means that black bodies are maimed and abused or killed in the process. There's a way in which this permissiveness that's given to police officers under the Fourth Amendment actually functions in very much the same way.
You know, I was thinking also of the swim club altercation. It also took place in Texas. We saw this teenage girl, Jeria Becton, taken down by this police officer. She's wearing a bathing suit, so clearly she's not armed or doing anything in particular. Dorothy, you're shaking your head.
So many aspects of what Kim and I are talking about are reflected in that encounter. This was a teenage girl. Obviously, there was no reason to fear her. She was in a bikini. The idea that children are to be protected and vulnerable does not apply to black children. To the murder of Tamir Rice is an example of that. But also we could see this happens to black girls as well. And we can extend this discussion from what goes on in the streets and in homes to schools. And I know Kim has reported on this as well, the high rates of police violence against girls in school, black girls in school, where the racial gaps in the abuse of girls is actually greater than that in the abuse of black boys versus white boys. So that incident reflects the lack of protection for black children, the excessive force that police officers use, but also going back to the theme that we were talking about, the idea that police are here to protect white people and that blacks are a threat and our rights can be sacrificed for that. That is such a, Kim, I'm so glad you brought that up because it's so important to understand that even the law, the Fourth Amendment law and other aspects of the law are designed to protect whites against blacks and the way in which police can abuse that discretion to use excessive force against black people does not then matter to the U.S. Supreme Court. It's also important to note that some of, going back to what David Harris was saying about the warrior mentality of police that harms all Americans, that, again, is on the backs of black people. The willingness of white Americans to sacrifice civil liberties so that they can feel safe from black people and keep black people in their place is something that white Americans need to grapple with. It's a major aspect of white supremacy and racism and a major reason why we're seeing this militarization of the police without the kind of broad-based protest that should be against it.
Let me get there. We have a lot of people that want to join the conversation. I'm not surprised. It looks like we have Nicole from Center City, Philadelphia. Hi, Nicole. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yes. So there's been a lot of discussion around the issue of the stop and what went on in the jail. What I haven't heard is whether she went before a judge, whether there was a public defender, why she wasn't released.
Those are all good questions.
Without bail being set, all of this, I'm an attorney. It all is just outrageous to me.
And Nicole, you say you're an attorney.
Yes.
And raising all these questions, we have we have three attorneys here.
Well, I think it is outrageous that she wasn't released. She shouldn't have even been in jail at all, but certainly she should have been released immediately. Bail was set. I believe it was set at $5,000, and she didn't have the $500 she needed on her. Her family was going to send it, but it shouldn't have even gotten that far. You know, this is another aspect of racial law enforcement, racist law enforcement, is the idea that it's no big deal for black people to spend time in jail. It's extremely disturbing that the idea that a black woman who all she was charged with initially was shifting lanes without a signaling ends up spending even 3 days in jail. And this is related to our bail system in this country, where thousands upon thousands of people spend time in jail just because they don't have the money for bail. Again, an aspect, an undemocratic aspect of our system, I would say even totalitarian aspect of our system,
And I wanted
you go ahead, Kim.
Actually build on what you were saying earlier, Dorothy, because if this was a risk that each and every American had to think about every day, it would not be part of our system. You know, jail time is a permissible punishment for lane changing. The only reason why that's still in the books is most people, most white people, don't think that they ever will encounter that desire to punish, right? So this entire system, from what happened to her when she was initially arrested to having this bail set in part so high because of the false allegation that she had assaulted a police officer. So the system redoubles the discrimination that she experienced in the first place. So this is what's going on behind the scenes. This is part of the whole conversation about mass incarceration, using the police system as a mechanism of social control. And it really wouldn't be this way if race didn't make most people think that the abuses that exist towards a community that either deserves them, or if they don't on an individual level, we want to maintain this level of enforcement because we think as a whole group, they are a threat to our society.
Nicole, thanks for the call. Let me see what Matt from Glenside has to say. Matt, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for my call.
You're welcome.
I'm a 52-year-old white male from a upper middle class environment growing up. And my father gave me the lecture when I started driving about police have too much immediate authority, and to not mouth off, always be courteous and polite, because being right doesn't mean you're not going to wind up in jail. And I can name, among people I know who are white, at least 10 instances where they have wound up in jail as a result of being pulled over in an automobile that had nothing to do with drinking or driving or intoxication or anything like that. My point is, I'm not naive enough to think that there's not institutional racism. My point is, this discussion being based solely on race takes away from the real issue of abuse of police authority. And you all were just starting to kind of get into that a little bit before you took my call.
Sure.
And I think the I don't know who it was, but the point that was made about this is something that everybody needs to be thinking about, because you don't know what's going to set somebody off.
Well, you know what, Matt? Let me take your point, only because it's a good one, and I know Dorothy wants to respond to it.
I think our point was that you cannot understand what happened to Sandra Bland without bringing race, racism, white supremacy into it. But I think both Kim and I were making the point that the reason why Americans allow for this kind of excessive police abuse, brutality, violence, even killing, is because of a fear of black people and a sense of a threat and a willingness to sacrifice black people's rights in order to protect white people. We have to ask, why is it that Americans put up with this warrior mentality of police? We're not saying that white people don't experience it too, but black people experience it at a far, far higher rate. So that for white people, it's not an everyday experience. And also, the message is that this is happening mostly to black people because, as Kim said, because they deserve it, because they're a threat. And so there isn't the kind of resistance to it that would occur if racism wasn't part of it. It's a more complicated point I think Kim and I are making. Not that it doesn't happen to white people, it only happens to black people, but you have to understand how racism supports a system, a legal system, a cultural system, a social system, a political system that permits this continued and even escalating militarization and violent enforcement of authority of police.
You know, Kim, I was wondering whether, and I don't know if this is going to make a difference or it matters, but interestingly, Sandra was came from a middle class family. She was college educated. She apparently had at least one or two job offers. So clearly this was a middle class family, a middle class woman. Does class figure into our conversation at all?
Well, I think the way class figures in is precisely in the way that you framed it, which is if we look at Sandra Bland, there are aspects of her identity, her situation, that repel those arguments that typically get expressed. In other words, when we narrate her that way, we are saying she is not, you know, part of how we imagine the criminal element to be. She had no reason to want to hide something. She had no reason to want to even kill herself. So part of this is a story that frequently gets used to talk about how many of the justifications that get generated for police violence, namely, we need this in order to protect ourselves against a cohort in the population that are ne'er-do-wells and just represent a threat to the body politics, often is not true. For the most part, it's not true. So class does play a role in making the fabrication of the broad argument, we need this in order to protect us, or more specifically, that group brought it on themselves. This helps make that argument. But more broadly, the argument should be normatively all black people, whether they just got a job or not, whether they were graduates from university or not, should be free from this kind of police abuse and violence. And if all black people are free from it, then the rest of the population would also be free from it. So the argument is you have to deal with race to deal with the problem, but the problem is one ultimately that we all should be concerned about.
Well, I'm trying to stop the clock because it tells me there's only a minute left and there's so much more to discuss. But and not to put a happy face on anything we've been discussing, Dorothy, but do you see this as an important moment? I mean, a moment where there can be this discussion about police interaction. I'm thinking about the Confederate flag. I mean, that was that moment where we could have this kind of discussion.
I see it as a moment where black protest, joined by allies of other groups, is at a very exciting point. It's at a point where people are not going to take this anymore and are organizing in very visible ways in social media, in the streets, in organizations like the two that Kim has founded to address at a more fundamental systemic level the police brutality that is part of a broader system of control, supervision over black people and affecting all Americans as well.
Well, as I said, we could go on much more to talk about. Dorothy Roberts, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. And we began our conversation with David Harris. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show, how to find us on Facebook, how to follow us on Twitter. In fact, we started a Facebook conversation on this hour of Radio Times. Claire Moran, the intern this summer for Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, our engineer. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.